Denise had always had trouble saying no when she felt wanted in the right way. Growing up in suburban St. Jude, she'd been kept at safe distances from anybody who might have wanted her in this way, but after she finished high school, she worked for a summer in the signal department of the Midland Pacific Railroad. And here, in a big, sunny room with twin rows of drafting tables, she became acquainted with the desires of a dozen older men. The brain of the Midland Pacific, the temple of its soul, was a Depression-era limestone office building with rounded rooftop crenellations like the edges of a skimpy waffle. Higher-order consciousness had its cortical seat in the boardroom and executive dining room on the 16th floor and in the offices of the more abstract departments, operations, legal, public relations, whose vice presidents were on 15. Down at the reptile brain bottom of the building were billing, payroll, personnel, and data storage. In between were mid-level skill functions, such as engineering, which encompassed bridges, track, buildings, and signals. The Midland Pacific lines were 12,000 miles long, and for every signal and every wire along the way, every set of red and amber lights, every motion detector buried in ballast, every flashing cantilever crossing guard, every agglomeration of timers and relays housed in a ventless aluminum shed, there were up-to-date circuit diagrams in one of six heavy-lidded filing tanks in the tank room on the 12th floor of headquarters. The oldest diagrams were drawn freehand in pencil on vellum, the newest with rapidograph pens on pre-printed Mylar blanks. The draftsmen who tended these files and liaised with the field engineers who kept the railroad's nervous system healthy and untangled were Texan and Kansan and Missourian natives, intelligent, uncultured, twangy men who'd come up the hard way from no-skill jobs and signal gangs, chopping weeds and digging post holes and stringing wire until, by virtue of their aptitude with circuits, and also, as Denise later realized, by virtue of being white, they'd been singled out for training and advancement. None had more than a year or two of college, most only high school. On a summer day, when the sky got whiter and the grass got browner, and their former gangmates were battling heatstroke in the field, the draftsmen were happy indeed to sit in cushioned roller chairs in air so cool they all kept cardigans handy in their personal drawers. "You'll find that some of the men take coffee breaks," Alfred told Denise in the pink of the rising sun as they drove downtown on her first morning. "I want you to know they're not paid to take coffee breaks. I expect you not to take coffee breaks yourself. The railroad is doing us a favor by hiring you, and it's paying you to work 8 hours. I want you to remember that. If you apply yourself with the same energy you brought to your schoolwork and your trumpet playing, you'll be remembered as a great worker." Denise nodded. To say she was competitive was to put it mildly. In the high school band, there had been 2 girls and 12 boys in the trumpet section. She was in the first chair, and boys were in the next 12. In the last chair was a part Cherokee girl from downstate who hit middle C instead of high E, and helped cast that pall of dissonance that shadows every high school band. Denise had no great passion for music, but she loved to excel, and her mother believed that bands were good for children. Enid liked the discipline of bands, the upbeat normality, the patriotism. Gary, in his day, had been an able boy trumpeter, and Chip had briefly, honkingly, attempted the bassoon. Denise, when her time came, asked to follow in Gary's footsteps, but Enid didn't think that little girls and trumpets matched. What matched little girls was flutes. But there was never much satisfaction for Denise in competing with girls. She'd insisted on the trumpet, and Alfred had backed her up, and eventually it had dawned on Enid that rental fees could be avoided if Denise used Gary's old trumpet. Unlike sheet music, unfortunately, The signal diagrams that Denise was given to copy and file that summer were unintelligible to her. Since she couldn't compete with the draftsmen, she competed with the boy who'd worked in signals the previous two summers, Alan Jamboretz, the corporation council's son. And since she had no way to gauge Jamboretz's performance, she worked with an intensity that she was certain nobody could match. "Denise, whoa, God damn!" Laredo Bob, a sweating Texan, said while she was cutting and collating blueprints. "What? You gonna burn yourself out going that fast?" "Actually, I enjoy it," she said, "once I'm in the rhythm."
"Thing is, though," Laredo Bob said, "you can leave some of that for tomorrow."
"I don't enjoy it that much."
"Okay, well, but y'all take a coffee break now, you hear me?"
Draftsmen were yipping as they trotted toward the hallway.
"Coffee time! Snack cart's here. Coffee time!"
She worked with undiminished speed. Laredo Bob was the low man to whom drudge work fell when there was no summer help to relieve him. Laredo Bob ought to have been chagrined that Denise, in full view of the boss, was performing in half an hour certain clerical tasks to which he liked to devote whole mornings while he chewed up a Swisher sweet cigar. But Laredo Bob believed that character was destiny. To him, Denise's work habits were simply evidence that she was her daddy's daughter and that soon enough she would be an executive just like her daddy while he, Laredo Bob, would go on performing clerical tasks at the speed you'd expect from somebody fated to perform them. Laredo Bob further believed that women were angels and men were poor sinners. The angel he was married to revealed her sweet, gracious nature mainly by forgiving his tobacco habit and feeding and clothing four children on a single smallish income. But he was by no means surprised when the eternal feminine turned out to have supernatural abilities in the area of labeling and alphabetically sorting thousand-count boxes of card-mounted microform. Denise seemed to Laredo Bob an all-around marvelous and purty creature. Before long, he began singing a rockabilly chorus, "Denise, why you done what you did?" when she arrived in the morning and when she returned from her lunch break in the little treeless city park across the street. The chief of draftsmen, Sam Boyerline, told Denise that next summer they would have to pay her not to come to work since she was doing the work of two this summer. A grinning Arkansan, Lamar Parker, who wore enormous thick glasses and had precancers on his forehead, asked her if her daddy had told her what a rascally, worthless crew the men of signals were.
"Just worthless," Denise said. "He never said rascally."
Lamar cackled and puffed on his tarriton and repeated her remark in case the men around him hadn't heard it.
"He-he-he,"
the draftsman named Don Armour muttered with unpleasant sarcasm. Don Armour was the only man in signals who seemed not to love Denise. He was a solidly built, short-legged Vietnam vet whose cheeks, close-shaved, were nearly as blue and glaucous as a plum. His blazers were tight around his massive upper arms. Drafting tools seemed toy-sized in his hand. He looked like a teenager stuck at a first grader's desk. Instead of resting his feet on the ring of his high-wheeled chair, like everyone else, he let his feet dangle, his toe tips dragging on the floor. He draped his upper body across the drafting surface, bringing his eyes to within inches of his rapidograph pen. After working for an hour like this, he went limp and pressed his nose into Mylar or buried his face in his hands and moaned. His coffee breaks, he often passed, pitched forward like a murder victim, his forehead on his table, his plastic aviator glasses in his fist. When Denise was first introduced to Don Armour, he looked away and gave her a dead fish handshake. When she worked at the far end of the drafting room, she could hear him murmuring things while the men around him chuckled. When she was close to him, he kept silent and smirked fiercely at his tabletop. He reminded her of the smartasses who haunted the back rows of classrooms.
She was in the women's room one morning in July when she heard Armour and Lamar outside the bathroom door by the drinking fountain where Lamar rinsed out his coffee mugs. She stood by the door and strained to hear.
"Remember we thought old Allen was a crazy worker?"
Lamar said.
"I'll say this for Jamborette's," Don Armour said. "He was a hell of a lot easier on the eyes."
"Hard to get much work done with somebody as good-looking as Allen Jamborette's walking around all day in little skirts."
"Allen was a pretty boy, all right."
There was a groan.
"I swear to God, Lamar," Don Armour said, "I'm this close to filing a complaint with OSHA. This is cruel and unusual. Did you see that skirt?"
"I seen it, but shush now.
I'm going crazy."
"This is a seasonal problem, Donald. It's like to take care of itself in 2 months."
"If the Roths don't fire me first."
"Say, what makes you so sure this merger's going through?"
"I sweated 8 years in the field to get to this office. It's about time something else came along and fucked things up."
Denise was wearing a short, electric blue, thrift store skirt that, in truth, she was surprised was in compliance with her mother's Islamic female dress code. To the extent that she accepted the idea that Lamar and Don Armour had been talking about her, and the idea did have an undeniable, strange, headache-like residency status in her brain, she felt all the more keenly snubbed by Don. She felt as if he were having a party in her own house without inviting her. When she returned to the drafting room, he cast a skeptical eye around the room, sizing up everyone but her. As his gaze skipped past her, she felt a curious need to push her fingernails into the quick or to pinch her own nipples. It was the season of thunder in St. Jude. The air had a smell of Mexican violence, of hurricanes or coups. There could be morning thunder from unreadably churning skies, ominous dull reports from South County municipalities that nobody you knew had ever been to, and lunch-hour thunder from a solitary anvil wandering through otherwise semi-fair skies, and the more serious thunder of mid-afternoon as solid sea-green waves of cloud rolled up in the southwest, the sun shining all the brighter locally, and the heat bearing down more urgently as if aware that time was short. And the great theater of a good dinner-time blowout, storms crowded into the 50-mile radius of the radar sweep like big spiders in a little jar, clouds booming at each other from the sky's four corners, and wave upon wave of dime-sized raindrops arriving like plagues, the picture in your window going black and white and fuzzy, trees and houses lurching in the flashes of lightning, small kids with swimsuits and drenched towels running home headlong like refugees. And the drumming late at night, the rolling caissons of summer on the march. And every day, the St. Jude press carried rumblings of an impending merger. The Mid-Pack's importunate twin-brother suitors, Hillard and Chauncey Roth, were in town talking to three unions. The Roths were in Washington countering Mid-Pack testimony before a Senate subcommittee. The Mid-Pack had reportedly asked the Union Pacific to be its white knight. The Roths defended their post-acquisitional restructuring of the Arkansas Southern. The Mid-Pack spokesman begged all concerned St. Judeans to write or call their congressman. Denise was leaving the building for lunch under partly cloudy skies when the top of a utility pole a block away from her exploded. She saw bright pink and felt the blast of thunder on her skin. Secretaries ran screaming through the little park. Denise turned on her heel and took her book and her sandwich and her plum back up to the 12th floor, where every day two tables of pinochle formed. She sat down by the windows, but it seemed pretentious or unfriendly to be reading War and Peace. She divided her attention between the crazy skies outside and the card game nearest her. Don Armour unwrapped a sandwich and opened it to a slice of bologna on which the texture of bread was lithographed in yellow mustard. His shoulders slumped. He wrapped the sandwich up again loosely in its foil and looked at Denise as if she were the latest torment of his day.
"Meld 16. Who made this mess?"
"Ed," Don Armour said, fanning cards. "You gotta be careful with those bananas." Ed Alberding, the most senior draftsman, had a body shaped like a bowling pin and curly gray hair like an old lady's perm. He was blinking rapidly as he chewed banana and studied his cards. The banana, peeled, lay on the table in front of him. He broke off another dainty bite.
"Awful lot of potassium in a banana," Don Armour said.
"Potassium's good for you," Lamar said from across the table.
Don Armour set his cards down and regarded Lamar gravely.
"Are you joking? Doctors use potassium to induce cardiac arrest."
"Old Eddie eats 2-3 bananas every day," Lamar said. "How's that heart of yours feeling, Mr. Ed?"
"Let's just play the hand here, boys," Ed said. "But I'm terribly concerned about your health," Don Armour said. "You tell too many lies, mister. Day after day I see you ingesting toxic potassium. It's my duty as a friend to warn you.
Your trick, Don.
Put a card down, Don."
"And in return, all I get," Armour said in an injured tone, "is suspicion and denial."
"Donald, you and this game are just keeping that seat warm."
"Of course, if Ed were to keel over dead of cardiac arrest due to acute long-term potassium poisoning, that would make me fourth highest in seniority and secure me a place in Little Rock with the Arkansas Southern / Midland Pacific. So why am I even mentioning this? Please, Ed, eat my banana, too."
"Watch your mouth," Lamar said.
"Gentlemen, I believe these tricks are all mine."
"Son of a gun!"
Shuffle, shuffle, slap, slap.
"Ed, you know, they got computers down in Little Rock," Don Armour said, never glancing at Denise.
"Uh-oh," Ed said. "Computers?
You go down there, I'm warning you. They're going to make you learn to use one."
"Eddie'll be asleep with angels before he learns computers," Lamar said.
"I beg to differ," Don said. "Ed's going to go to Little Rock and learn computer drafting. He's going to make somebody else sick to their stomach with his bananas."
"Say, Donald, what makes you so sure you ain't going to Little Rock yourself?"
Don shook his head. "We'd spend $2,000-$3,000 less a year if we lived in Little Rock, and pretty soon I'd be making a couple thousand a year more. It's cheap down there. Patty could work maybe half days, let the girls have a mother again. We could buy some land in the Ozarks before the girls got too old to enjoy it, some place with a pond. You think anybody's going to let that happen to me?"
Ed was sorting his cards with the nervous twitches of a chipmunk.
"What do they need computers for?" he said.
"To replace useless old men with," Don said, his plum face splitting open with an unkind smile.
"Replace us?
Why do you think the Roths are buying us out and not the other way around?"
Shuffle, shuffle, slap, slap. Denise watched the sky stick forks of lightning into the salad of trees on the Illinois horizon. While her head was turned, there was an explosion at the table.
"Jesus Christ, Ed," Don Armour said. "Why don't you just go ahead and lick those before you put them down?"
"Easy there, Don,"
said Sam Boyerline, the chief of draftsmen.
"Am I alone in this turning my stomach?"
"Easy, easy."
Don threw his cards down and shoved off in his rolling chair so violently that the praying mantis drafting light creaked and swayed.
"Laredo," he called, "come take my cards. I gotta get some banana free air."
"Easy."
Don shook his head.
"It's say it now, Sam, or go crazy when the buyout happens."
"You're a smart man, Don," Boyerline said. "You'll land on your feet no matter what."
"I don't know about smart. I'm not half as smart as Ed. Am I, Ed?"
Ed's nose twitched. He tapped the table with his cards impatiently.
"Too young for Korea, too old for my war," Don said. "That's what I call smart. Smart enough to get off the bus and cross Olive Street every morning for 25 years without getting hit by a car. Smart enough to get back on it every night. That's what counts for smart in this world."
Sam Boyerline raised his voice.
"Don, now you listen to me. You go take a walk. You hear? Go outside and cool down. When you get back, you may decide you owe Eddie an apology."
"Meld 18, Ed said, tapping the table.
Don pressed his hand into the small of his back and limped up the aisle, shaking his head. Laredo Bob came over with egg salad in his mustache and took Don's cards.
"No need for apologies," Ed said.
Let's just play the hand here, boys. Denise was leaving the women's room after lunch when Don Armour stepped off the elevator. He had a shawl of rain marks on his shoulders. He rolled his eyes at the sight of Denise, as if at some fresh persecution.
What? She said.
He shook his head and walked away.
What? What?
Lunch hour's over, he said. Aren't you supposed to be working? Each wiring diagram was labeled with the name of the line and the milepost number. The signal engineer hatched plans for corrections, and the draftsmen sent paper copies of the diagrams into the field, highlighting additions in yellow pencil and subtractions in red. The field engineers then did the work, often improvising their own fixes and shortcuts, and sent the copies back to headquarters, torn and yellowed and greasily fingerprinted, with pinches of red Arkansas dust or bits of Kansas weed chaff in their folds, and the draftsmen recorded the corrections in black ink on the Mylar and vellum originals. Through the long afternoon, as the perch belly white of the sky turned the color of a fish's flanks and back, Denise folded the thousands of off-prints she'd cut in the morning, six copies of each in the prescribed folds that fit in the field engineer's binder. There were signals at mileposts 16.2 and 17.4 and 20.1 and 20.8 and 22.0 and so on up to the town of New Charters at 74.35, the end of the line. On the way out to the suburbs that night, she asked her father if the Roths were going to merge the railroad with the Arkansas Southern.
"I don't know," Alfred said. "I hope not."
Would the company move to Little Rock?
That seems to be their intention if they get control.
What would happen to the men in signals?
I'd guess some of the more senior ones would move, the younger ones probably laid off. But I don't want you talking about this.
I won't, Denise said.
Enid, as on every other Thursday night for the last 35 years, had dinner waiting. She'd stuffed green peppers and was abubble with enthusiasm about the coming weekend.
"You'll have to take the bus home tomorrow," she told Denise as they sat down at the table. "Dad and I are going to Lake Fond du Lac Estates with the Schumperts." "What is Lake Fond du Lac Estates?"
"It is a boondoggle," Alfred said, "that I should have known better than to get involved with. However, your mother wore me down."
"Al," Enid said, "there are no strings attached. There is no pressure to go to any of the seminars. We can spend the whole weekend doing anything we want."
"There's bound to be pressure. The developer can't keep giving away free weekends and not try to sell some lots."
"The brochure said no pressure, no expectation, no strings attached."
"I am dubious," Alfred said.
"Mary Beth says there's a wonderful winery near Bordentown that we can tour, and we can all swim in Lake Fond du Lac, and the brochure says there are paddle boats and a gourmet restaurant."
"I can't imagine a Missouri winery in mid-July is going to be appealing," Alfred said.
"You just have to get in the spirit of things," Enid said. "The Driblets went last October and had so much fun. Dale said there was no pressure at all, very little pressure, he said."
"Consider the source."
"What do you mean?"
"A man who sells coffins for a living."
"Dale's no different than anybody else."
"I said I am dubious, but I will go," Alfred added. To Denise, "You can take the bus home. We'll leave a car here for you."
"Kenny Craikmeyer called this morning," Enid told Denise. "He wondered if you're free on Saturday night."
Denise shut one eye and widened the other.
"What did you say?" "I said I thought you were." "You what? I'm sorry, I didn't realize you had plans."
Denise laughed.
"My only plan at the moment is to not see Kenny Craikmeyer." "He was very polite," Enid said. "You know, it doesn't hurt to go on one date if somebody takes the trouble to ask you. If you don't have fun, you don't have to do it again, but you ought to start saying yes to somebody. People will think nobody's good enough for you."
Denise set down her fork.
"Kenny Craikmeyer literally turns my stomach."
"Denise," Alfred said.
"That's not right," Enid said, her voice trembling. "That's not something I want to hear you saying." Okay, I'm sorry I said that. But I'm not free on Saturday, not for Kenny Craikmeyer, who, if he wants to go out, might consider asking me.
It occurred to Denise that Enid would probably enjoy a weekend with Kenny Craikmeyer at Lake Fond du Lac, and that Kenny would probably have a better time there than Alfred would. After dinner, she biked over to the oldest house in the suburb, a high-ceilinged cube of antebellum brick across the street from the boarded-up commuter rail station. The house belonged to the high school drama teacher, Henry Dusenbert, who'd left his campy Abyssinian banana and gaudy crotons and tongue-in-cheek potted palms in his favorite student's care while he spent a month with his mother in New Orleans. Among the bordello-ish antiques in Dusenbert's parlor were 12 ornate champagne glasses, each with an ascending column of air bubbles captured in its faceted crystal stem that he allowed only Denise, of all the young thespians and literary types who gravitated to his liquor on Saturday nights, to drink from. "Let the little beasts use plastic cups," he would say, as he arranged his wasted limbs in his calfskin club chair. He had fought two rounds against a cancer now officially in remission, but his glossy skin and protuberant eyes suggested that all was not well oncologically. "Lambert, extraordinary creature," he said. "Sit here where I can see you in profile. Do you realize the Japanese would worship you for your neck? Worship you." It was in Dusenbert's house that she'd tasted her first raw oyster, her first quail egg, her first grappa. Dusenbert steeled her in her resolve not to succumb to the charms of any, his phrase, pimpled adolescence. He bought dresses and jackets on approval in antique stores, and if they fit Denise, he let her keep them. Fortunately, Enid, who wished that Denise would dress more like a Schumpert or a Root, held vintage clothing in such low esteem that she actually believed that a spotless embroidered yellow satin party dress with buttons of tiger-eye agate had cost Denise, as she claimed, $10 at the Salvation Army. Over Enid's bitter objections, she'd worn this dress to her senior prom with Peter Hicks, the substantially pimpled actor who'd played Tom to her Amanda in the Glass Menagerie. Peter Hicks, on prom night, had been invited to join her and Dusenbert in drinking from the Rococo champagne glasses, but Peter was driving and stuck with his plastic cup of Coke. After she watered the plants, she sat in Dusenbert's calfskin chair and listened to New Order. She wished she felt like dating someone, but the boys she respected, like Peter Hicks, didn't move her romantically, and the rest were in the mold of Kenny Craikmeyer, who, though bound for the Naval Academy in a career in nuclear science, fancied himself a hipster and collected Cream and Jimi Hendrix vinyl, his word, with a passion that God had surely intended him to bring to building model submarines. Denise was a little worried by the degree of her revulsion. She didn't understand what made her so very mean. She was unhappy to be so mean. There seemed to be something wrong with the way she thought about herself and other people. Whenever her mother pointed this out, though, she had no choice but to nuke her. The next day she was taking her lunch hour in the park, sunning herself in one of the tiny sleeveless tops that her mother was unaware she wore to work beneath her sweaters, when Don Armour appeared from nowhere and dropped onto the bench beside her. "You're not playing cards," she said.
"I'm going crazy," he said.
She returned her eyes to her book. She could feel him looking at her body pointedly. The air was hot, but not so hot as to account for the heat on his side of her face. He took his glasses off and rubbed his eyes.
"This is where you come and sit every day."
"Yes." He wasn't good-looking. His head seemed too large, his hair was thinning, and his face had the dusky nitrite red of a wiener or bologna, except where his beard made it blue. But she recognized an amusement, a brightness, an animal sadness in his expression, and the saddle curves of his lips were inviting. He read the spine of her book.
"Count Leo Tolstoy," he said.
He shook his head and laughed silently.
What?
Nothing, he said. I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be you.
What do you mean?
I mean, beautiful, smart, disciplined, rich, going to college. What's it like?
She had a ridiculous impulse to answer him by touching him, to let him feel what it was like. There was no other way, really, to answer. She shrugged and said she didn't know.
Your boyfriend must feel very lucky, Don Armour said.
I don't have a boyfriend.
He flinched, as if this were difficult news.
I find that puzzling and surprising.
Denise shrugged again.
I had a summer job when I was 17, Don said. I worked for an old Mennonite couple that had a big antique store. We used this stuff called magic mixture, paint thinner, wood alcohol, acetone, tongue oil. It would clean up the furniture without stripping it. I'd breathe it all day and come home flying. Then around midnight I'd get this wicked headache.
Where'd you grow up?
Carbondale, Illinois. I had this idea that the Mennonites were underpaying me in spite of the free highs, so I started borrowing their pickup at night. I had a girlfriend who needed rides. I crashed the pickup, which was how the Mennonites found out I'd been using it, and my then-stepdad said if I enlisted in the Marines, he would deal with the Mennonites and their insurance company. Otherwise, I was on my own with the cops. So I joined the Marines in the middle of the 60s. It just seemed like the thing to do. I've got a real knack for timing.
You were in Vietnam.
Don Armour nodded.
If this merger goes through, I'm back to where I was when I was discharged. Plus 3 kids and another set of skills that no one wants.
How old are your kids?
10, 8, and 4.
Does your wife work?
She's a school nurse. She's at her parents' in Indiana. They've got 5 acres and a pond. Nice for the girls.
Are you taking some vacation?
2 weeks next month.
Denise had run out of questions.
Don Armour sat bent over with his hands pressed flat between his knees. He sat like this for a long time. From the side, she could see his trademark smirk wearing through his impassivity. He seemed like a person who would always make you pay for taking him seriously or showing concern. Finally, Denise stood up and said she was going inside. And he nodded, as if this were a blow he'd been expecting. It didn't occur to her that Don Armour was smiling in embarrassment at the obviousness of his play for her sympathies, the staleness of his pickup lines. It didn't occur to her that his performance at the pinochle table the day before had been staged for her benefit. It didn't occur to her that he'd guessed she was eavesdropping in the bathroom and had let himself be overheard. It didn't occur to her that Don Armour's fundamental mode was self-pity, and that he might, in his self-pity, have hit on many girls before her. It didn't occur to her that he was already plotting, had been plotting since he first shook hands with her, how to get into her skirt. It didn't occur to her that he averted his eyes not simply because her beauty caused him pain, but because rule number 1 in every manual advertised at the back of men's magazines how to make her wild for you every time was ignore her. It didn't occur to her that the differences of class and circumstance that were causing her discomfort might be for Don Armour a provocation, that she might be an object he desired for its luxury, or that a fundamentally self-pitying man whose job was in jeopardy might take a variety of satisfactions in bedding the daughter of his boss's boss's boss. None of this occurred to Denise then or after. She was still feeling responsible 10 years later. What she was aware of that afternoon were the problems. That Don Armour wanted to put his hands on her but couldn't
was a problem, that through an accident of birth she had everything, while the man who wanted her had so much less. This lack of parity was a big problem. Since she was the one who had everything, the problem was clearly hers to solve. But any word of reassurance she could give him, any gesture of solidarity she could imagine making, felt condescending.
She experienced the problem intensely in her body.
Her surfeit of gifts and opportunities, in comparison to Don Armour's, manifested itself as a physical botheration, a dissatisfaction that pinching the sensitive parts of herself might address, but couldn't fix. After lunch, she went to the tank room, where the originals of all signal tracings were stored in 6 heavy-lidded steel tanks resembling elegant dumpsters. Over the years, the big cardboard folders in the tanks had become overloaded, collecting lost tracings in their bulging lower depths, and Denise had been given the satisfying task of restoring order. Draftsmen visiting the tank room worked around her while she relabeled folders and unearthed long-lost vellums. The biggest tank was so deep that she had to lie on her stomach on the tank beside it, her bare legs on cold metal, and dive in with both arms to reach the bottom. She dropped the rescued tracings on the floor and reached in for more. When she surfaced for air, she became aware that Don Armour was kneeling by the tank. His shoulders were muscled like an oarsman's and stretched his blazer tight. She didn't know how long he'd been here or what he'd been looking at. Now he was examining an accordion-pleated vellum, a wiring plan for a signal tower at milepost 101.35 on the McCook line. It had been drawn freehand by Ed Alberding in 1956. Ed was a kid when he drew this. It's a beautiful thing. Denise climbed down from the tank, smoothed her skirt, and dusted herself off. I shouldn't be so hard on Ed, Don said. He's got talents I'll never have. He seemed to be thinking less about Denise than she'd been thinking about him. He uncrumpled another tracing, and she stood looking down at a boyish whorl of his pencil-gray hair. She took a step closer, and leaned a little closer yet, eclipsing her view of him with her chest. "You're kind of in my light," he said.
"Do you want to have dinner with me?"
He sighed heavily, his shoulders slumped. "I'm supposed to drive to Indiana for the weekend."
"Okay.
But let me think about it."
"Good. Think about it."
She sounded cool, but her knees were unsteady as she made her way to the women's room. She locked herself in a stall and sat, and worried while outside the elevator bell faintly chimed and the afternoon snack cart came and went. Her worrying had no content. Her eyes simply alighted on something, the chrome bolt on the door of the stall, or a square of tissue on the floor. And the next thing she knew, she'd been staring at it for 5 minutes and had thought about nothing. 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 She was cleaning up the tank room 5 minutes before day's end, when Don Armour's broad face loomed up at her shoulder, his eyelids drooping sleepily behind his glasses. "Denise," he said, "let me take you to dinner." She nodded quickly.
"Okay."
In a rough neighborhood, mostly poor and black, just north of downtown, was an old-fashioned soda shop and diner that Henry Duzenberry and his student thespians patronized. Denise had appetite for nothing more than iced tea and French fries, but Don Armour ordered a hamburger platter and a milkshake. His posture, she noticed, was a frog's. His head sank into his shoulders as he bent to the food. He chewed slowly, as if with irony. He cast bland smiles around the room, as if with irony. He pushed his glasses up his nose with fingers whose nails, she noticed, were bitten to the pink. "I would never come to this neighborhood," he said.
"These couple of blocks are pretty safe."
See, for you, that's true, he said. A place can sense if you understand trouble. If you don't understand it, you get left alone. My problem is I understand it. If I had come to a street like this when I was your age, something ugly would have happened.
I don't see why.
It's just the way it was. I would look up and suddenly there would be three strangers who hated my guts and I hated theirs. This is a world you can't even see if you're an effective and happy person. A person like you walks right through it. It's waiting for someone like me to come along so I can have the shit beat out of me. It's had me picked out from a mile away.
Don Armour drove a big American sedan similar to Denise's mother's, only older. He piloted it patiently onto an artery and headed west at a low speed, amusing himself by slouching at the wheel. I'm slow. My car's bad. While other drivers roared by on the left and right. Denise directed him to Henry Dusenbear's house. The sun was still shining, low in the west above the plywood-eyed train station when they mounted the stairs to Dusenbear's porch. Don Armour looked up at the surrounding trees as if even the trees were somehow better, more expensive in this suburb. Denise had her hand on the screen door before she realized that the door behind it was open.
"Lambert, is that you?"
Henry Dusenbear came out of the gloom of his parlor. His skin was waxier than ever, his eyes more protuberant, and his teeth seemed larger in his head.
"My mother's doctor sent me home," he said. "He wanted to wash his hands of me. I think he's had enough of death."
Don Armour was retreating toward his car, head down.
"Who's the Incredible Hulk?" Dusenbear said.
"A friend from work," Denise said.
"Well, you can't bring him in, I'm sorry. I won't have Hulks in the house. You'll have to find someplace else."
"Do you have food? Are you all right here?"
"Yes, run along. I feel better already being back. That doctor and I were mutually embarrassed by my health. Apparently, child, I'm quite without white blood cells." The man was shaking with fear. He was convinced that I was going to die right there in his office. Lambert, I felt so sorry for him.
A dark hole of mirth opened in the sick man's face.
I tried to explain to him that my white blood cell needs are entirely nugatory, but he seemed intent on regarding me as a medical curiosity. I had lunch with Mother and took a taxi to the airport.
"You're sure you're okay?"
"Yes, go with my blessing. Be foolish, but not in my house. Go."
It was unwise to be seen with Don Armour at her house before dark, with observant roots and curious driblets coming and going on the street. So she directed him to the elementary school and led him into the field of grass behind it. They sat amid the electronic menagerie of bug sounds, the genital intensity of certain fragrant shrubs, the fading heat of a nice July day. Don Armour put his arms around her belly, his chin on her shoulder. They listened to the dull pops of small-bore fireworks. In her house after dark, in the frost of its air conditioning, she tried to move him quickly toward the stairs, but he tarried in the kitchen. He lingered in the dining room. She was pierced by the unfairness of the impression that the house was obviously making. Although her parents weren't wealthy, her mother so yearned for a certain kind of elegance and had worked so hard to achieve it that to Don Armour the house looked like the house of rich people. He seemed reluctant to tread on the carpeting. He stopped and took proper note, as possibly no one else ever had, of the Waterford goblets and candy dishes that Enid kept on display in the brick front. His eyes fell on each object, the music boxes, the Parisian street scenes, the matching and beautifully upholstered furniture, as they'd fallen on Denise's body. Was it just today? Today at lunch? She put her large hand in his larger hand, knitted her fingers into his, and pulled him toward the stairs. In her bedroom, on his knees, he planted his thumbs on her hip bones and pressed his mouth to her thighs and then to her whatever.
She felt returned to a childhood world of Grimm and C.S. Lewis, where a touch could be transformative. His hands made her hips into a woman's hips. His mouth made her thighs into a woman's thighs, her whatever into a cunt. These were the advantages of being wanted by someone older. To feel less like an ungendered marionette, to be given a guided tour of the state of her morphology, to have its usefulness elucidated by a person for whom it was just the ticket. Boys her own age wanted something, but they didn't seem to know exactly what. Boys her own age wanted approximately. Her function, the role she'd played on more than one lousy date, was to help them learn more specifically what they wanted, to unbutton her shirt and give them suggestions, to, as it were, flesh out their rather rudimentary ideas. Don Armour wanted her minutely, inch by inch. She appeared to make brilliant sense to him. Simply possessing a body had never much helped her. But seeing it as a thing that she herself might want, imagining herself as Don Armour on her knees, desiring the various parts of herself, made her possession of it more forgivable. She had what the man expected to find. There was no anxiety to his location and appreciation of each feature. When she unhooked her bra, Don bowed his head and shut his eyes.
What is it?
A person could die of how beautiful you are.
This she liked, yes.
Her feeling when she took him in her hands was a preview of her feeling a few years later as a young cook, when she handled her first truffles, her first foie gras, her first sacks of roe. On her 18th birthday, her theater friends had given her a hollowed-out Bible containing a nip of Seagram's and 3 candy-colored condoms, which came in handy now. Don Armour's head, looming above her, was a lion's head, a jack-o'-lantern. When he came, he roared. His subsiding sighs overtook one another, overlapped almost. Oh, 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 oh! She'd never heard anything like it. There was blood in proportion to her pain, which had been fairly bad, and in reverse proportion to her pleasure, which had been mainly in her head. In the dark, after she'd grabbed a dirty towel from the laundry basket in the hall closet, she pumped her fist at having achieved non-virginity before she left for college. Less wonderful was the presence of a large and somewhat bloody man in her bed. It was a single bed, the only bed she'd ever slept in, and she was very tired. This perhaps explained why she made a fool of herself by standing in the middle of her room with a towel wrapped around her and unexpectedly weeping. She loved Don Armour for getting up and wrapping his arms around her and not minding that she was a child. He put her to bed, found a pajama top for her, helped her into it. Kneeling by the bed, he drew the sheet up over her shoulder and stroked her head, as she had to assume he often stroked his daughter's heads. He did this until she was nearly asleep. Then the theater of his stroking expanded into regions that she had to assume were off-limits with his daughters. She tried to stay half asleep, but he came at her more insistently, more scratchily. Everything he did either tickled or hurt. And when she made so bold as to whimper, she had her first experience of a man's hands pressing on her head, pushing her southward. Thankfully, when he was done, he didn't try to spend the night. He left her room, and she lay utterly still, straining to hear what he was doing and whether he was coming back. Finally, she may have dozed. She heard the click of the front door's latch, and the whinny of his big car's starter. She slept until noon, and was showering in the downstairs bathroom shower stall, trying to comprehend what she'd done, when she heard the front door, again, heard voices. She madly rinsed her hair, madly toweled off, and burst out of the bathroom. Her father was lying down in the den. Her mother was rinsing out the insulated picnic hamper in the kitchen sink.
"Denise, you didn't eat any of the dinner I left you," Enid cried. "It doesn't look like you've touched a single thing." I thought you guys were coming back tomorrow. Lake Fond du Lac was not what we expected, Enid said. I don't know what Dale and Honey were thinking. It was a big nothing.
At the bottom of the stairs were two overnight bags. Denise ran past them and up to her bedroom, where condom wrappers and bloody linens were visible from the doorway. She closed the door behind her. The rest of her summer was ruined. She was absolutely lonely, both at work and at home. She hid the bloody sheet and the bloody towel in her closet and despaired of dealing with them. Enid was naturally surveillant and had myriad idle synapses to devote to such tasks as noticing when her daughter had her period. Denise hoped to come forward apologetically with the ruined towel and sheet at the appropriate time 2 weeks hence. But Enid had brain power to spare for the counting of linens.
"I'm missing one of my good monogrammed bath towels." "Oh, shoot, I left it at the pool." "Denise, why you took a good monogram bath towel when we have so many other towels, and then of all the towels to lose? Did you call the pool?"
I went back and looked.
"Those are very expensive towels."
Denise never made mistakes like the one she was claiming to have made. The injustice would have rankled less if it had served a greater pleasure, if she could have gone to Don Armour and laughed about it and sought his consolation. But she didn't love him, and he didn't love her. At work now, the friendliness of the other draftsmen was suspect. It all seemed liable to lead to fucking. Don Armour was too embarrassed or discreet to even meet her eyes. He spent his days in a torpor of unhappiness with the Roth brothers and unfriendliness to everyone around him. There was nothing left for Denise at work but work, and now its dullness was a burden. Now she hated it. By the end of a day, her face and neck hurt from holding back tears and working at speeds that only a person working happily could maintain without discomfort. This, she told herself, was what happened when you acted on an impulse. She was amazed that she'd given all of 2 hours' thought to her decision. She'd taken a liking to Don Armour's eyes and mouth. She'd determined that she owed him the thing he wanted, and this was all she remembered thinking. A dirty and appealing possibility had occurred to her.
I could lose my virginity tonight.
And she'd leaped at the chance. She was too proud to admit to herself, let alone to Don Armour, that he wasn't what she wanted. She was too inexperienced to know she simply could have said, "Sorry, big mistake." She felt a responsibility to give him more of what he wanted. She expected that an affair, if you took the trouble to start it, went on for quite a while. She suffered for her reluctance. The first week in particular, while she worked herself up to proposing to Don Armour that they get together again on Friday night, her throat ached steadily for hours on end. But she was a trooper. She saw him on the next 3 Fridays, telling her parents that she was dating Kenny Craikmeyer. Don Armour took her to dinner at a strip mall family restaurant, and then back to his flimsy little house in a tornado alley exurb, one of 50 small towns that St. Jude in its endless sprawl was swallowing. His house embarrassed him to the point of loathing. No houses in Denise's suburb had ceilings so low or hardware so cheap, or doors too light to slam properly, or window sashes and window tracks made of plastic. To soothe her lover and shut him up on the topic, your life versus mine, that she least enjoyed, and also to fill some hours that would otherwise have passed awkwardly, she pulled him down on the hide-a-bed in his junk-swamped basement and brought her perfectionism to bear on a whole new world of skills. Don Armour never said how he'd explained to his wife his cancellation of their weekend plans in Indiana. Denise couldn't stand to ask one question about his wife. She endured criticism from her mother for another mistake that she would never have made, failing to soak a bloody sheet immediately in cold water. On the first Friday of August, moments after Don Armour's 2-week vacation started, he and Denise doubled back into the office and locked themselves in the tank room. She kissed him and put his hands on her tits and tried to work his fingers for him, but his hands wanted to be on her shoulders. They wanted to press her to her knees. His stuff got up into her nasal passages.
"Are you coming down with a cold?" her father asked her a few minutes later while they were driving past the city limits.
At home, Enid gave her the news that Henry Dusenbear, your friend, had died at St. Luke's on Wednesday night. Denise would have felt even guiltier if she hadn't visited Dusenbear in his house as recently as Sunday. She found him in the grip of an intense irritation with his next-door neighbor's baby.
"I'm doing without white blood cells," he said. "You'd think they could shut their goddamn windows. My God, that infant has lungs. I suspect they're proud of those lungs. I suspect it's like those bikers who disconnect their mufflers. Some spurious, savage token of manhood."
Dusenbear's skull and bones were pushing ever closer to his skin. He discussed the cost of mailing a 3-ounce package. He told Denise a meandering, incorrect story about an octoroon to whom he'd briefly been engaged.
"If I was surprised that she was only 7/8 white, imagine her surprise that I was only 1/8 straight."
He spoke of his lifelong crusade on behalf of 50-watt light bulbs.
60's too bright," he said, "and 40 is too dim."
For years he'd lived with death and kept it in its place by making it trivial. He still managed a reasonably wicked laugh. But in the end, the struggle to hold fast to the trivial proved as desperate as any other. When Denise said goodbye and kissed him, he seemed not to apprehend her personally. He smiled with downcast eyes, as if he were a special child whose beauty was to be admired and whose tragic situation pitied. She never saw Don Armour again, either. On Monday, August 6th, after a summer of give and take, Hillard and Chauncey Roth reached agreement with the principal rail workers' unions. The unions had made substantial concessions for the promise of less paternalistic, more innovative management, thus sweetening the Roths' $26 per share tender offer for the Midland Pacific with a potential near-term savings of $200 million. The Mid-Pac's board of managers wouldn't vote officially for another 2 weeks, but the conclusion was foregone. With chaos looming, a letter came down from the president's office accepting the resignations of all summer employees effective Friday, August 17th. Since there were no women, besides Denise, in the drafting room, her co-workers prevailed on the signal engineer's secretary to bake a farewell cake. It came out on her last afternoon of work.
"I reckon it's a major victory," Lamar said, munching, "that we finally made you take a coffee break."
Laredo Bob dabbed at his eyes with a handkerchief the size of a pillowcase. Alfred passed along a compliment in the car that night.
"Sam Boyerline," he said, "tells me you're the greatest worker he's ever seen."
Denise said nothing.
"You made a deep impression on those men. You opened their eyes to the kind of work a girl can do. I didn't tell you this before, but I had the feeling the men were dubious about getting a girl for the summer. I think they expected a lot of chattering and not much substance."
She was glad of her father's admiration. But his kindness, like the kindness of the draftsmen who weren't Don Armour, had become inaccessible to her. It seemed to fall upon her body, to refer to it somehow, and her body rebelled.
"Denise, why you done what you did?" "Anyhow," her father said, "now you've had a taste of life in the real world."
Until she actually got to Philadelphia, she'd looked forward to going to school near Gary and Caroline. Their big house on Seminole Street was like a home without home's sorrows, and Caroline, whose beauty could make Denise breathless with the sheer privilege of speaking to her, was always good for reassurance that Denise had every right to be driven crazy by her mother. By the end of her first semester of college, though, she found that she was letting Gary leave 3 messages on her telephone for every message she returned. Once, just once, there was a message from Don Armour, which she likewise did not return. She found herself declining Gary's offers to pick her up at her dorm and return her after dinner. She claimed she had to study, and then, instead of studying, she watched TV with Julia Vrace. It was a hat trick of guilt. She felt bad for lying to Gary, worse for blowing off her work, and worst of all for distracting Julia. Denise could always pull an all-nighter, but Julia was useless after 10 o'clock. Julia had no motor and no rudder. Julia could not explain why her fall schedule consisted of intro Italian, intro Russian, Eastern religion, and music theory. She accused Denise of having had unfair outside help in choosing her balanced academic diet of English, history, philosophy, and biology. Denise, for her part, was jealous of the college men in Julia's life. Initially, both she and Julia had been besieged. An inordinate number of the junior and senior men who banged their trays down beside them in the dining hall were from New Jersey. They had middle-aged faces and megaphonic voices with which they compared math curricula or reminisced about that time they went to Rehoboth Beach and got so wasted. They had only 3 questions for Julia and Denise. 1, what's your name? 2, what dorm are you in? And 3, do you want to come to our party on Friday? Denise was amazed by the rudeness of this summary exam, and no less amazed by Julia's fascination with these teenage natives with monster digital wristwatches and merging eyebrows. Julia wore the heads-up look of a squirrel, convinced that somebody has stale bread in his pocket. Leaving a party, she would shrug and tell Denise, "He's got drugs, so I'm going with him." Denise began to spend Friday nights studying by herself. She acquired a rep as an ice queen and possible lesbian. She lacked Julia's ability to melt at the window side chorusing of her name at 3 in the morning by the entire college soccer team. "I'm so embarrassed," Julia would moan in an agony of happiness as she peered around the lowered blind. The men outside the window had no idea how happy they were making her and therefore, in Denise's strict undergraduate judgment, did not deserve to have her. Denise spent the next summer in the Hamptons with 4 of her dissolute college hallmates and lied to her parents about every aspect of her situation. She slept on a living room floor and made good money as a dishwasher and prep drone at the inn at Quag, working elbow to elbow with a pretty girl from Scarsdale named Susie Sterling and falling in love